In 2009, game designer Jane McGonigal suffered a severe concussion. It left her dealing with debilitating anxiety and depression. To cope, McGonigal turned her game designing skills on the problems she was facing. The result was the game Super Better, a game that operated at the crossroads of real life and technology. McGonigal says Super Better and games like it can be used for real-world results and make us feel happier, empowered, and more resilient.
Jane McGonigal joins us now. She's a senior researcher at the Institute for the Future and the author of the bestseller Reality is Broken. Her new book is called Super Better, a revolutionary approach to getting stronger, happier, braver, and more resilient. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, you start your book by saying that you want people to learn how to be gameful. Now, we're used to hearing the word mindful. You're saying gameful in the face of extreme stress and personal challenges. What do you mean by that word, gameful?
Gameful describes the mindset that we naturally adopt whenever we play games. So if you think about your favorite game, it could be a sport, it could be a card game, it could be a video game. We're really willing to, you know, learn and improve. We know we're going to fail a lot. We stay optimistic and motivated. We recruit allies to help us. And this sort of sense of being wholeheartedly engaged with difficult challenges and drawing on creativity and optimism to stay engaged, that's really a gameful mindset. And most of us don't bring that mindset to our real-life challenges. But if you do, it turns out it can actually help you be physically healthier, you know, more resilient to stress, happier, and have better outcomes.
Now, you know about this firsthand. You've been through this. You were yourself dealing with anxiety and depression after a concussion. And to get you through it, you turned it into a game. Obviously, this is your vocation, too, so there was a synergy there. And that first game was called, you called it Jane the Concussion Slayer. Why was your first instinct to turn your recovery into a game?
You know, it wasn't actually my first instinct. It took me more than a month to figure that out. And it was, you know, a month of really severe depression, anxiety. And after a month of that, some part of my brain, you know, which I wasn't thinking very clearly, I wasn't even really able to work, but some part of my brain remembered something that I had learned. And by that point, I'd been studying the psychology of games for 10 years. And I remembered this research finding from the 1950s and 60s, a psychologist at play who had said that the opposite of play isn't work, it's depression. And, you know, it turns out now, neurologically, that's true. When we look at fMRI studies of video gamers, the two regions of the brain that are hyperactivated when we play games are the same two regions of the brain that are understimulated and even shrink over time when we're clinically depressed. So, you know, there was just some part of me thinking, if play is the opposite of depression, that's clearly what I need more of right now to help me heal my brain and to stop suffering in this way.
Well, you were lucky that you had the skills to design this thing for yourself. So what did you put into the game that helped you get better? How did that game work?
Well, I wanted to try to get myself doing all of the same things that we do in video games to help us tackle tough obstacles more successfully, just to try to do that in my life. And it was, admittedly, at first it was a pretty kind of silly concept. It was just this role-playing game where I would do things like make lists of power-ups for my real life. So, you know, like a power-up in a video game, you could have the power pellet in Pac-Man that lets you eat all the ghosts, or the mushroom in Super Mario makes you 10 times faster and stronger. I was trying to figure out, well, what are the power-ups for my real life so that I can have a chance to feel a positive emotion or have more physical energy, you know, making lists of bad guys. What are the things that are really frustrating me during this recovery or causing me physical pain or causing me anxiety? And I decided that every day I would battle one bad guy, you know, instead of just trying to avoid the things that were difficult for me. I would tackle them, see where I stood. Am I getting better? You know, am I improving, recovering, and just doing the things that were making me feel anxious or frustrated. So really, then there's a whole slew of things, you know, recruiting allies, doing quests, doing secret identity, all the things that we do in games that help us stay motivated and determined and actually learn and improve better as we play the game, trying to do those same things in my life.
Can you give me a real-life example from Jane the Concussion Slayer? Now, you said you battled a bad guy every day. What did that mean?
Yeah, well, you know, this is true for a lot of people with any kind of disabling injury or illness. you know, when you have a traumatic brain injury, there are a lot of things that you can't do at first because they trigger your symptoms. They trigger headaches or nausea, vertigo. So for me, it was things like bright lights, crowded spaces, long conversations with other people. And in the beginning, you really try to avoid these things to help your brain heal. This is true for people with back pain. You know, they avoid things that create pain. If you have fatigue from an illness, you'll avoid doing things that exhaust you. But it turns out that there's a kind of a tipping point where you have to start reengaging. Otherwise, you become kind of committed to this idea that there are things I can't do anymore. And that's actually the best predictor of who goes on to develop a long-term disability. People who spent too much time avoiding the things that trigger symptoms. So for me, you know, I knew, for example, if I went into the supermarket and within a couple of minutes, the kind of lighting they have in supermarkets would make me dizzy and almost pass out. But I would still try to come up with ways to test and challenge myself. You know, well, if I can only spend 3 minutes in the store, you know, what can I get in 3 minutes? And you try to think agency, maybe 4 minutes next time, maybe 5 minutes the next time I try, and don't take it for granted that it's black and white as to what you are capable of or not. So that, for me, that was a helpful thing to do during this sort of pretty, you know, serious time of disability.
We're talking with Jane McGonigal right now about the potential of games and using that gaming mindset to make us stronger, braver, and more resilient. She's a senior researcher at the Institute for the Future and the author of the new book, Super Better. And you can call us now with your experience. Do you think that mindset that we use when we play a game, turning things into play when it's a personal hardship, do you see that as being something that you can harness to get through a tough time? Have you done it yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the potential of games and the mindset that we use in games to make us stronger, braver, and more resilient. Jane McGonigal stays with us. She's a senior researcher at the Institute for the Future and the author of the new book. It's called Super Better. And you can call us now with your stories. Did you use this kind of gaming mindset, turning things maybe kind of into play as you do in games to get through a tough time? How did that work for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Jane, you eventually shared this game with the world. You put it up online, changed the name from Jane the Concussion Slayer to Super Better. What did people tell you about how they were using it and what they were going through?
Well, we actually had more than 500,000 people now use this digital version of the game. So we've learned a lot. You know, I can tell you the top five challenges that people have used it for are depression, anxiety, chronic pain, chronic illness, and PTSD. And we've actually been able to do a couple of really rigorous scientific studies to see, you know, is this really working? Who does it work for? With the University of Pennsylvania, we did a randomized control study and found that for people with clinical depression, adopting this gameful mindset using the Super Better method significantly reduced depression and anxiety in 30 days. And we did an NIH-funded clinical trial with Ohio State University Medical Research Center, and that was with young people with mild and moderate traumatic brain injuries. And they also were able to become significantly less depressed, and actually their traumatic brain injury symptoms alleviated faster than people who didn't use the method, which is really an exciting finding because there aren't a lot of treatments right now for post-concussion syndrome. So it's kind of amazing. It sounds like such a silly or trivial approach, but we've been really eager to collect enough data and run the studies to show that something that sounds, you know, very lighthearted like a game can still help with a really serious problem.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the science behind it and what's going on in the brain. So why does it work the way it does, and what are we seeing in the real world?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's really interesting, you know, we know now that when you look at fMRI studies of gamers, the two regions of the brain that get hyperactivated when we play games are the motivation center of the brain and the learning center of the brain. So the motivation center, which are the reward pathways, when you have more blood flow to those regions of the brain, you feel more optimistic about your goals. You have an easier time staying focused and determined on them, even when you're facing setbacks. you'll do whatever it takes to achieve a positive outcome. And when the hippocampus is activated, which is the learning center of the brain, you pay a special kind of attention that allows you to process feedback faster and more effectively so that you really are able to learn and improve. And, you know, of course, whenever you play a game, your motivation center is activated because every game is about a goal. You're trying to solve the puzzle or rescue the princess or get a certain score. And the learning center activates because every game is designed for us to be bad at it the first time we play. You know, level one is easy. You have to figure out how the game works and get better and improve. And so these two regions of the brain getting hyperactivated, they allow us to actually be more successful and more resilient when we're trying to achieve goals. And what we're doing with SuperBetter is trying to help people activate the same regions of the brain that are so important for resilience in the face of challenges. And so that's sort of one of the underlying mechanisms for how this is working.
And it sounds like there's some research showing that people who may witness or go through a traumatic experience, they can play a game right afterwards, like Tetris, and maybe the memory doesn't imprint as painfully, or they're getting their wounds changed, and it may be a game helps them there. What are some of those new studies?
Yeah, one of the things that was important for me to do for this book was to collect all of the research looking at the use of games for mental and physical health. And there are actually more than 500 studies that I reference in the book. One of the ones that I think people find really fascinating is the one that you mentioned about using a game like Tetris to prevent PTSD. So there have been three Oxford studies now showing that if you play Tetris, ideally within 6 hours, but it looks like it may work in up to 24 hours, within 6 to 24 hours of a traumatic event, that your brain will actually form flashbacks of the game, which if you've ever played Tetris, you know, if you watch all those little puzzle pieces falling and you're so focused on that when you walk away, you still see the puzzle pieces falling. Your brain flashbacks on the game instead of on the trauma. So people who use this technique have fewer flashbacks and then fewer symptoms of PTSD, because flashbacks, that's actually the hardest to treat symptom, the kind of signature symptom of PTSD. Now, what's interesting is it doesn't wipe out the memory. If you're asked for factual information about the trauma, you can remember it as vividly as somebody who didn't play Tetris. What it stops is your brain from obsessively and involuntarily recalling the trauma, because the brain will, when it has a choice, focus on a current challenge or something that's at hand. So you're basically controlling the mind's eye and saying, I want you to be focused on this visual stimuli and not remembering the trauma.
It's so interesting. Jane, thank you so much. We have to leave it there. Appreciate your time today.
Sure. Thanks for helping folks get super better.
That was Jane McGonigal, senior researcher at the Institute for the Future. Her new book is called Super Better, a revolutionary approach to getting stronger, happier, braver, and more resilient.
UW-Madison will soon put in place a new curriculum for healthcare students aimed at screening drug and alcohol use among patients. Supporters of the program say it can save the state money because of the high costs related to things like binge drinking and drug addiction.
The new training plan is possible thanks to a grant from the federal government. UW students in nursing, pharmacy, medicine, and other healthcare disciplines will start that program in January.
Joining us now is Dr. Richard Brown, professor of family medicine and community health at UW-Madison. He'll be in charge of implementing and evaluating this program. Dr. Brown, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, talk us through what kinds of training will these healthcare students get to help them deal with issues related to drug and alcohol?
Well, we will be training them to screen all of their patients for alcohol and drug issues by asking a few simple questions. If those questions suggest risk, they'll be trained to administer some validated questionnaires that indicate what level of risk or problem the patient has. For patients with a medium level of risk or problem, they'll be trained to administer what we call brief interventions, services that can help decrease drinking and drug use that are administered right there in general healthcare settings. And most people who screen positive fall into that category. But then for the small number of people who they find might be addicted to alcohol or drugs, they'll be trained to make referrals for specialty-based treatment.
Yeah, when I heard drug and alcohol in relation to this program, my brain automatically filled in the gap with addiction. But you're looking at more than addiction when it comes to health risks related to drug and alcohol. Can you expand on that a little?
Sure. Well, for alcohol in particular, we have about 30% of individuals who would benefit from drinking less in Wisconsin. And it turns out that only about 3% are actually alcoholic. The other 27% are drinking at levels that are exposing them to risk for health and social problems, or maybe even suffering some of those problems already. And the good news is that since that 27% is not alcoholic, they don't need to go to treatment. They can actually decide to cut down on their own and actually often be effective.
When I'm at a doctor's office, I think part of a screening is usually a question about smoking. So are you seeing this effort as something along those lines?
Absolutely. There are a number of important behavioral risk factors that predispose to many kinds of health and social problems. So there's smoking, drinking, drug use, depression, diet, exercise, and obesity. And the federal government and others are really pushing us in healthcare to do a better job addressing all of these issues, because if we did, we would improve the health of the population and we would substantially decrease healthcare costs.
Well, let's see how this would work in practice. Say one of these people does the screening, they find their patient is at risk for, say, binge drinking. What's the next step? What kind of things can they do to help that patient out?
Well, what they can do is to actually deliver brief intervention. That involves giving some feedback and education on why that level of drinking or drug use might be risky or harmful. They can make recommendations, for example, to cut back to certain levels of drinking that we know are safer for individuals. If patients agree to cut back to that amount, they can help them develop behavior change plans. If patients are not ready to cut back to that amount but still willing to cut back a little, then we train practitioners to ally with patients and get behind whatever positive changes they're willing to make. And then it's best if they can conduct follow-up maybe a month later and see how things are working.
Wisconsin is unfortunately well known for problems with alcohol and drinking and driving. Is that part of why this grant happened, why you pursued this particular part of it?
It sure is. Yeah, we have a terrible drinking and driving problem. We typically have the highest rates of binge drinking when the annual surveys come out. There's so much suffering that people and their family members and sometimes innocent bystanders in communities endure because of our high rates of risky and problem drinking.
Talking to Dr. Richard Brown from UW-Madison about a new grant that's going to help train the healthcare workers of the future to help spot and help treat risks associated with drinking and or drugs. And Dr. Brown, I said healthcare providers of the future. There's also part of this effort that will work, as I understand it, with current healthcare providers. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is a 3-year grant, and in all 3 years, we'll be reaching UW trainees. But in years 2 and 3 of the grant, we will be engaged in outreach to communities around the state and hopefully find many current practitioners who would like to be trained in these skills.
Is it your hope that this eventually isn't a special training thing? It just kind of becomes standard operating procedure in healthcare facilities?
That would be wonderful, and it's always a chicken and egg problem. You know, we have lots of health professional students coming through who need to be trained, but often individuals who are in a position to train them did not get trained in these skills when they were in training. So how do we jumpstart that? And so one of the innovative aspects of this curriculum is that all of the training will be conducted online. The students will participate in interactive learning modules. There'll be some mini lectures with typical PowerPoint slides, but interspersed among them will be quizzes and other participatory activities. And once they have the knowledge that's necessary, they will practice online via something like Skype with individuals who are trained to portray patients and are trained to give feedback to the trainees. And then they'll have a final session with those so-called standardized patients or actor patients, where we make sure the trainees actually are competent to deliver these services to real patients.
So they'll role play this out. Is this a common way to train doctors, a role-playing exercise with fake patients?
Yes, it's become quite common because we recognize that it's not sufficient just to have classroom activities and reading where people learn knowledge. We have to train individuals to interact well with patients, and skills in in that realm are just hugely important to determining whether healthcare practitioners will be effective.
We focused in on alcohol a little bit. Also wanted to bring up an issue that seems to be a growing problem here in Wisconsin, abuse of opiate prescription drugs and illegal drugs like heroin. How is this curriculum teaching students to interact with patients, try to help with solutions to those issues?
We will be training the students in an approach called motivational interviewing. With motivational interviewing, we avoid giving lots of unwanted advice and information that often elicits lots of defensiveness. Instead, we train the trainees to engage in conversations with patients so that patients actually take stock by themselves. For example, we may ask patients what they like about their drug use. We may then ask them, have they recognized any downsides or do they have any fears or risks if things continue? And so often, just by asking those open-ended questions, we get patients to talk about reasons they already might have to quit or cut down, and there are approaches to take to draw more and more of that so-called change talk out of patients. And lots of research shows the more that we get patients to make their own arguments for change and strengthen those arguments, the more likely that they'll follow through. Well, that's very different from the traditional physician that may wag their finger and say, you'd better cut down. That, we know, is usually not effective.
I was going to say, that's very different than a scolding approach or a scare tactic sort of thing. Is that getting to be the norm, not just in alcohol and drug use, but diet and exercise for that matter?
Yeah, motivational interviewing was actually developed as a treatment technique within the addiction field, but there's now been over 1,200 studies in the peer-reviewed healthcare literature showing that it's quite effective for a wide variety of behavioral risks and unhealthy behaviors, and it's effective when administered by a wide variety of healthcare professionals.
So you've got this grant. You're working on this for 3 years. Many current health provider students and some current people out in the field. What's next? I know this is a part two for you. You did some work like this at UW-La Crosse. What do you see moving forward?
Well, even if these trainees are well trained to do this, then the next question is, are there future workplace settings well adapted to allow them to actually deliver these services? And we know that all healthcare professionals are very, very busy, and they just simply wouldn't have the time to deliver all the intervention and referral services to all of their patients who would screen positive for risky drinking, drug use, smoking, diet, exercise, obesity, et cetera. So part of the training will also focus on how they can change their future practices. For example, could they expand the healthcare teams of the futures so that maybe there are health educators or coaches in place who actually have the time to have these important interactions with patients that many current healthcare providers simply don't have?
Dr. Brown, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Richard Brown, professor of family medicine and community health at UW-Madison. He'll be overseeing a new training program for UW healthcare students aimed at screening and treating drug and alcohol risks early on.